This is How Success Happens, where the staff of Entrepreneur chats with innovators, writers, artists, chefs, and a range of other unique personalities to better understand the traits that make excellence possible.
Nobody in Silicon Valley thinks it's actually them. They think everybody else is like this.
One of my regrets actually now, we should have pulled the plug sooner.
It's amazing when the universe sees you commit, how all of a sudden all these resources start to come together.
Thanks for joining us. And now, How Success Happens.
Hey there, Hayden Field here. I'm an associate editor at Entrepreneur, and I'm here with Jean Case, the tech industry pioneer, investor, and philanthropist. Her number of awards and accolades, not to mention influential board positions, is much too long to list. But know that besides her position as CEO of the Case Foundation, which she co-founded with her husband, Steve, she's also chairman of the Board of Trustees for the National Geographic Society. And, of course, formerly a senior executive at AOL. Her new book on success and risk-taking, Be Fearless, came out on January 8th. We'll talk to her about that and her advice to entrepreneurs who want to change the world. But first, a word from our sponsors. Fundrise is the future of real estate investing. Fundrise enables you to instantly access high-quality, high-potential private market real estate projects from high-rises in D.C. to multifamily apartments in L.A. Each real estate project is carefully vetted and actively managed by Fundrise's team of real estate pros. The platform's innovations power an investor-first model by eliminating the bloated costs and middlemen that have traditionally weighed down real estate investing, saving investors time and money. Fundrise's unparalleled transparency and real-time reporting let you see how the development of specific properties impact your overall portfolio. Visit fundrise.com/HSH. That's FUNDRISE.com/HSH to have your first 3 months of fees waived. Again, that's fundrise.com/HSH. And now for our second sponsor. If you have a business or you know someone who does, you probably know that small business owners wear a lot of hats. And some of those hats are totally great, but some, like filing taxes and running payroll, for example, not so great. That's where Gusto comes in. Gusto makes payroll, taxes, and HR actually easy for small businesses. Fast, simple payroll processing, benefits, and expert HR support all in one place. Gusto automatically pays and files your federal, state, and local taxes so you don't have to worry about it. Plus, they make it easy to add on health benefits and even 401ks for your team. Those old school, clunky payroll providers just weren't built for the way modern small businesses work, but Gusto is. So let them wear one of your many hats. You have better things to do. Listeners get 3 months free when they run their first payroll. Try a demo and see for yourself at gusto.com/HSH. That's gusto.com/HSH. Jean, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Hayden. I've really been looking forward to this conversation.
I'm so excited to have you. As I just told you, I'm a big fan of the National Geographic Society and yours.
I am too.
Yeah, I'm excited to be talking to you. First, I know you recently released your new book, Be Fearless, so congratulations.
Thank you.
I think a lot of our entrepreneurs, their first question would be, how did you actually get that done? It's so hard to start a project like that. It can seem so overwhelming. And then actually bring it to fruition. What was your number one strategy for making that happen?
Well, in fairness, I have to tell you, it comes out of work we had done almost 6 years ago at the Case Foundation, where we looked around, and entrepreneurs will definitely relate to this. We looked around and said, you know, geez, why is it as people chase opportunities or challenges, sometimes they break through and sometimes they don't? And could there be a special sauce behind that? So we went to school on that, hired some researchers, and what came out is really the framework of the book, which is five principles wherever we see transformational breakthroughs come around. So for me, perhaps writing the book was a bit easier because I've been living with this material and talking about this material for quite some number of years now. But what really led to sort of writing a book about it was seeing the influence it had in the lives of people, whether they be entrepreneurs, innovators, change makers, movement builders, you name it. As they set out to apply these principles, they discovered that it was something they could really use in their lives as well.
Absolutely, that makes sense. And I know two of your principles center on making a big bet and taking bold risks. And I know a lot of our listeners are probably wondering, especially if they've got limited capital and are considering quitting their day job, how do you take a calculated risk?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I must say that the very first chapter is titled Start Right Where You Are. And I really, it is a storytelling book. So although it's the five principles, we really try to tell stories to illustrate how these principles can be applied or have been applied for people who found success. The idea of starting right where you are is kind of almost taking an audit, if you will, of your strengths and sort of what you have that you can start with. And I'll give you an example of the woman who started a nonprofit that we opened the book with. And I think her story is important because even though it's not a for-profit company, I think any entrepreneur could see the entrepreneurial spirit alive in the story. You know, she was a sole practitioner, a mental health counselor, and she saw a challenge out across our nation about a decade ago when men and women in the military were coming home and facing a lot of mental health challenges. And their families were as well due to, you know, long stays overseas, multiple tours, et cetera. So she, of course, said, well, what could I do about it? And for her, that was an easy answer. Well, I could do an hour a week pro bono. Well, then she asked a few friends, could you do an hour a week pro bono? And then she had her really big idea, which is, could we create a national network and do the same thing? So Barbara had this really great idea for this national network, and so she engaged doctors around the country, and today there's thousands and thousands that provide free medical service. So many millions of dollars in free mental health counseling that has been made available to veterans and their families. In fact, Time named her one of the nation's 100 most influential people. So, you know, she had great success. But then there's also, we're here in New York City, there's a young entrepreneur, Shazi Visram, who was at Columbia Business School here, and she had some friends who are starting, you know, families and having babies at home, and they wanted healthy choices in their baby food, and they didn't want to have to make all the baby food in order for it to be a healthy choice. So she saw that, and she really couldn't believe there was a gap in the market like that. So like any entrepreneur, she saw a problem, and she set out to solve it. So she played around with some recipes and different ways she might be able to make baby food that she could turn into a company, which she did. It was called Happy Family. And Shazi has made a great success of this company. She exited to the big company, Danone, who's just as committed today to sort of that impact that she was having as a company by delivering healthy baby food products before just weren't available.
That's awesome. I love that. And yeah, I mean, it always does come from seeing a problem and then creating the solution yourself. I mean, I can't believe that there was not already a market for it. Healthy baby food,
right,
that you know what's in it.
I mean, exactly. It's really quite amazing when we look out across the world. And I must say, or even just look around, like think about Shazi. It was just what she was living and what she saw. And going back to your question, you know, if someone has an idea, you know, pay attention to what you're seeing. What ideas have you thought of maybe to solve a problem or to bring impact somewhere? And how could you begin starting right where you are to test out some ideas? And, you know, I do talk about in the book this concept that probably there's never been a better or easier time to test out different things. We talk about, of course, minimum viable product strategies where you could do the least amount of work, right? The least amount of, say, money to put into something, time, and just how could you begin to test out if an idea makes sense or not. Technology allows us to do a lot of things, to do what we might call test market signals before we go so far as to start a company or actually build a product.
Right. That makes sense. What if you see a problem in an industry you don't have a lot of experience in? I know some entrepreneurs, they'll be exploring another industry or they have friends in another industry and they say, okay, I see this hole, but I don't have as much experience in this industry, so I don't know exactly how to solve the problem, but I have a few ideas. What would you say about that?
Gosh, sometimes that's the greatest benefit you could have, is not being sort of absorbed in a topic. You can go out there and create solutions and disrupt in ways people who sort of grew up in that industry may not even think about. And I tell the story of the Airbnb founders, and you may know, their business really started because they had to pay rent and their backs were against the wall. So they knew this design conference was coming to San Francisco and all the hotel rooms were selling out or were too expensive for some of the young design people that wanted to come into town and go to this conference. So they came up with the idea of air mattresses on their floor for $80 an air mattress. They would rent it out. And they did three, and they successfully rented out the three. And the really big thing they did was offer a breakfast in the morning. Airbnb, of course, not just a bed but breakfast. But really, I think their whole idea was so much bigger than just, you know, I want to be in the hospitality business. They really wanted to build a way for consumers to feel at home when they travel, to really feel a sense of what it means to be home versus just flying through something. And if you look at their success today, I think they are successful because they weren't steeped in an industry where they were thinking about certain rules as they went forward. So it really can be an advantage sometimes.
That makes sense. Yeah, I love that. I mean, the outside perspective can really give you new eyes in a way. And then I wanted to ask, I know you've been involved with NGS for 12 plus years. So why is it important to you, and what's your vision for what the society will move to accomplish over the next 5 to 10 years in this day and age?
Yeah, well, you know, the National Geographic Society in many ways is more relevant today than it has been in its 130-year history. As an organization and brand, we have the largest social media footprint in the world of any brand. And, you know, we love it. It's a nonprofit. It's the National Geographic Society. We have over 90 million Instagram users. But we touch or engage with over 1 billion people every single month. So we feel really good about the democratization of exploration and science. Some of the new technologies are enabling all kinds of really cool new citizen science stuff. And one thing that's really changed that I think your listeners might be interested in knowing, and maybe some of them should think about it for themselves, is that used to be National Geographic Society just made grants, right? Grants to, you know, explorers, grants to educators, et cetera. Well, today, entrepreneurs are building such exciting mission-focused companies alongside that some of what used to be grant money now will actually go to invest in some of these entrepreneurs. So many of our explorers today are actually entrepreneurs. So it's a big change, and I'm excited by it because I kind of feel like now we're all rowing together. We have exciting, innovative startups who are helping drive our mission. For instance, there's one company that is building a drone, an underwater drone, to begin more exploration of our rivers and our waterways. And, you know, some places are being explored for the first time because of this low-cost drone that you can put out into the water and, you know, explore remotely.
That's great. I love that. And I think our listeners would definitely be interested in that. Speaking of investing, I know that you're a pioneer in impact investing as well. So what's your best piece of advice for founders who are hoping to pitch their idea to investors or friends and family so that it really stands out? I know you've heard a lot of pitches.
We have, yeah. And particularly in the impact realm, I don't think it's really all that different than any other startup as they think about the big idea. Well, for entrepreneurs who are building impact companies, or really just any entrepreneur, often we want to look at the strength of the idea and really the person behind it. You know, is there a passion and a powerful belief that they can take this forward? Is the idea big enough? Is it bold enough? You know, the principles that I talked about that are in the book start with make a big bet and make history. And often when I'm at pitch competitions or I'm listening to someone pitch his or her company, you know, what I'm really listening for is, are they being as bold as they can be to take a really big idea forward? And by the way, I think there are a lot of entrepreneurs who maybe along life's path tried some things and didn't find success. For many investors like me, that actually is not a showstopper at all. In many ways, if you've had, you know, a few hiccups along the way, a few failures, you know, the third principle is make failure matter. And that is, look, pick up, you know, stare it in the face, learn from it, and go forward. So sometimes I'm more inclined to get behind an entrepreneur who maybe has had one or two startups that didn't make it on the belief that they're carrying those important lessons forward and be more effective in their future company.
I think that's great, and I think it's amazing that sometimes, you know, you can take that failure and use it to your advantage to succeed. But what's one of the best pitches you've heard in terms of, you know, how they opened, how they held themselves? Are there any actionable strategies you would use to bolster an entrepreneur who's maybe pitching for the first time and wants to make sure they present themselves confidently and use their experience to really sell it?
Absolutely. Well, obviously, being able to communicate the idea is really most important, and particularly in something like a pitch competition where often you're having to do the elevator pitch. So you really have to be crisp. You really have to know what it is that you want to convey. Look, you might believe in your idea, but you have to understand that others aren't steeped in it like you are. So figuring out that quick way to convey what is the big idea. But perhaps most common when I judge pitch competitions, entrepreneurs that I think sometimes don't think about something, is they're reluctant to talk about their competition. And I think competition is something that anybody looking at an idea will say, what's already out there? And in the book, actually, I talk about Thomas Edison, because we think of him as this brilliant inventor, right? We still call it, like, the aha moment is called the light bulb moment, right? But in fact, what he said was, what he was good at was being a sponge. And that was going to school on everything that had happened before he started working on his patent. And then while he was working on it, paying attention to what was happening around him. I think any entrepreneur that goes to school on what's been tried in this idea, who could emerge as a competitor, will have much more credibility with a potential investor than one who says, I haven't really thought about that, or is reluctant to talk about it.
You've done great things with AOL, Case Foundation, and a whole host of other organizations, and I know you're passionate about using tech to make the world a better place. What's the most important thing to remember in the current landscape as tech companies become more and more evolved and collect greater amounts of data?
You know, it's funny. I think that there are a lot of challenges that we face around tech and whether in the end it's best serving consumers and the population more broadly. But I'm super optimistic still about the power of tech to change lives. You know, when we started AOL, we were on a mission to democratize access to ideas, information, and communication. And I still think that's a brilliant mission, and we still need to work on it because not everybody has access today. But it's quite possible that we can chase all these exciting new ideas with tech and still embrace an ethos of ethics, where basically we're asking ourselves the questions along the way. Does this best serve a population? You know, how could it be turned and used for evil? And what might we build into products, services, or even, you know, guidelines and frameworks around how we run our companies to make sure that we're keeping those things in mind? And that particularly leaders, the entrepreneurs and the founders, convey that ethos of, you know, I care about doing good. I care about making sure that my products or services are being used for public good.
Absolutely. And I know at the dawn of the internet, you know, you obviously joined AOL super early on when it was just a startup. Is there anything now that you see as being primed for that same sort of trajectory? I know at the dawn of the internet, people were like, oh, this is just a fad. It's really not that big of a deal. It's going to go away, or it's not going to go as far as it actually did.
Yeah. Well, I would take it even one step further and say we recall very clearly people saying, why would I need an email address? Or why would my company ever need a website? So we really have come a long way. You know, I think that we still have a long way to go. One of the, when you look out, and particularly for entrepreneurs, when you look out across society, whether it's here in the U.S. or around the world, there's some sectors that still haven't been fully disrupted. I'll give you an example of some of them. Ag tech, you know, agricultural technology. Tons of opportunity there to deploy new technology to help farmers, both with yield, with their crops, I mean, even in planning what they do, you name it, with food, right? Where we're beginning to see some real innovations around food that may eliminate the need for cattle all over the world, which are hurting our planet. So, you know, but I would also say ed tech, where in education, we've just begun really to deploy technology to be something that's used broadly to help students learn in new and innovative ways, where maybe they'll reach a population that won't be necessarily touched by the traditional form of education, or simply won't have access to it. So for instance, I'm engaged and invested in a company in Kenya that is bringing internet to the last mile. And so it's putting the internet in public places and in schools. So for many of that population, it's the only time they'll actually access the internet. So I think we still have a long way to go. But I'm very optimistic about the various sectors that still can be disrupted in powerful ways with new companies and new innovations.
Now that more and more tools are coming out to help monitor and limit our time spent on screens, what do you think our device use will look like in the next 5 years or so?
Well, it's funny, you know, because like if you think about restaurants and when they started putting calories on their menus, I think they believed that would change consumer behavior. I don't know if it has. It'll be interesting to see if a report out on your screen time does influence, you know, how you use. But I also believe that I've seen the pendulum swing, right? So I do think we're coming out of a period where people are in crosswalks looking at their phone, at dinner with each other looking at their phone. I think the pendulum's going to swing back, and people are going to realize the best life is a life of being fully engaged in the moment and hopefully seeing, you know, some of these devices as true tools and resources to aid our life and maybe aid our work, but not something that's meant for kind of the 24/7 that it's really become.
Absolutely. I've seen a lot of tech executives have actually put huge limits on their kids' screen
time.
And I know when I go out to dinner with my friends, we all put our phones like in the middle of the table or in our bags and say, don't take it out until we're done. So,
right. I think those kind of being mindful and also supported by a community that agrees with you is really what often leads to consumer change.
Definitely agreed. In all the work you've done with the foundation, I'm sure you've seen a lot of business ideas, big and small. So what's the single best question that those listening can ask themselves to determine whether their idea has legs and whether it can really make a difference in the world?
I would say it's not really specifically one thing, but two. And that is, you know, I talked about that first principle in Be Fearless being make a big bet. And if anything, I think every entrepreneur should say, you know, is this bet big enough? Am I dreaming big enough? Is the idea big enough? And the second thing really is, am I being bold enough in the way I'm going forward? You know, have I tapped the people who can help me get there? One of the principles we haven't talked about is one called reach beyond your bubble. And that idea is really being aware of what you bring to the party in terms of experience, background, talent, but more importantly, what don't you have at the table or on your team, and making sure that you've reached as far as you can through partnerships, through, you know, people you tap to come be part of your team, et cetera, to really find people who are not only different than you, but can play an active role in taking your idea even further. And usually that will be further and faster along the way.
I love that idea because we're, you know, I think a lot of entrepreneurs feel that they're pressured to be everything or good at everything, and you're just not going to be. And the power is in knowing where you're weak or less strong maybe, and who can fill that gap and bring on a team to bolster you. So I love that.
Yeah, and if you look at sort of new tech, meaning, you know, the next generation of tech, I think we've seen some really great examples of founders that we all hold up as, you know, icons of entrepreneurship, but they were very wise about bringing in people to lead their companies in many cases who brought with them experiences and operating companies and executing off of things that maybe they didn't have. And I just think that's so important when you're building towards something to make sure that you've filled in those gap areas.
Absolutely. Did you guys do that with the Case Foundation at all?
We did. And I have today. I mean, I feel like the team around me is world class, but it was definitely something we did at AOL as well. I mean, we would hire folks who had built their own companies. You know, the guy that really helped bring the internet revolution forward by creating sort of the network that supported it was a guy who had years and years of experience from IBM. And, you know, we used to refer to him as the dad because we were all in our 20s and he was like 50. But, you know, we really needed that at the table, somebody who was kind of tried and true and had seen it all. And he ended up playing a transformative role in the company.
Well, thank you so much, Jean. It's such a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Hayden.
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
That's our episode. We hope you enjoyed it. How Success Happens comes out every week. To catch each episode, please subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Like, share, and leave us a review so we can always be improving. Go to entrepreneur.com for more episodes of this show and our other great podcasts. That's entrepreneur.com. Thanks!